Shabbat Shalom. At risk of Monday morning quarterbacking the greatest story ever told, there's one question that in the 15 chapters leading up to the liberation of the Israelites from Egypt that should have been asked but never was. It was not for lack of opportunity to do so. Moses could have asked the question when he stood with God at the burning bush. As the brothers prepared to go before Pharaoh to demand their people's freedom, Aaron and Moses could have conferred with each other on this question. When the instruction came as to how each Israelite household should prepare the Passover ritual, maybe that was the window that Moses could have paused two beats to address the proverbial elephant in the room. Or maybe, just maybe, as the pressure mounted, as the quantity and potency of the plagues intensified, as the outcome of the story became increasingly inevitable, perhaps our great leader could have taken a second to reflect on those three simple words that could have and should have been voiced, but alas, were not. The small question of what comes next. What comes next? Nobody asked. Not God, not Aaron, not Moses, not anyone. They had enough time to bake the matzah. They had enough time to think about what they would say to future generations about their liberation. Moses even had enough time to identify the ancient remains of Joseph so they can be reinterred in the promised land. But at no time did they stop to think about the day after liberation. What would it be like as free men and women? As slaves, the Israelites lived under the yoke of Egyptian rule. As the plagues were inflicted and the sea split, it would be God's will and outstretched arm that would determine Israel's fate. But what about after that, when it was and would be the will of the people, not God or Pharaoh, who would determine the outcomes? How would the people respond? After leading the insurgency, what would Moses' new leadership role be? How would he lead the people and provide for their needs? What comes next? You've been freed. Do you know how hard it is to lead? You're on your own. Do you have a clue as to what happens now? At no point in the race to freedom did Moses stop to anticipate and adapt to the new normal that was waiting for him and his people. And if the chapters following the song at the sea prove anything, it is that question of what comes next that would have been really, really helpful to consider before the children arrived at the other side of the Sea of Reeds. Not one verse passes before the shouts of joy and freedom turn to kvetching and complaining as the Israelites discover themselves to be without drinkable water. What shall we drink? The people cry out to Moses, who in turn call out to God for help. The people's thirst shifts to hunger, and their grumblings grow more strident. If only we had died in Egypt, the people proclaim, their recollections of bitter bondage transformed into sweet nostalgia. There we sat by the flesh pots. There we ate our fill of bread. You, Moses, have brought us into the wilderness to starve to death. This crisis is averted with the arrival of manna, though it comes with one caveat, a prohibition against collecting it on the Sabbath, a law that's immediately broken, yet again provoking Moses' wrath. A second water crisis emerges, and Moses strikes a rock to produce water. The pressure mounts from the outside as the Israelites are attacked by Amalek, the newly liberated slaves thrust into their first military skirmish, with Moses' hands growing weary as Joshua and the people fight until the setting of the sun. It's an altogether sobering few chapters of biblical narrative. Scarcely had Pharaoh and his chariots plummeted into the sea than the circumstances of the Israelites plunged far lower than anyone imagined possible. Considering that the Israelites' liberation was hundreds of years in the making, it's nothing short of jarring to consider just how ill-informed and ill-equipped, how flat-footed Moses and the Israelites were for what they should expect the day after their freedom. So much heartache and pain could have been avoided had Israel considered what awaited them. The late governor Mario Cuomo once wrote that you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. What he meant, I think, is that the attributes necessary to be elected or lead a revolution do not lend themselves well to the daily demands of governance. Important as vision may be, it's the ability to implement that's the difference between failure and success. Only very rarely does history provide a Washington, a Ben-Gurion, or a Mandela, a leader capable of flexing multiple muscle groups as liberator, founding father, and gracious steward to a new generation of leadership. Moses was the liberator of our people, a teacher of Torah par excellence, a man who shared an intimacy with God second to none. But even he had his limitations. Yes, he felt the pain of the Israelites. Yes, he translated empathy into action, striking down the Egyptian and standing up to Pharaoh. But what Moses could not and did not do was prepare himself and the Israelites for the day after, to instill in them self-sufficiency, to teach them resilience, to model for them compromise and conflict resolution. In the chapters to come, Moses' hand would be forced to delegate towards a flatter organizational structure, but old habits die hard. The irony of it all, of course, being that Moses' early success was driven by precisely the same qualities that would prove to be his most profound stumbling blocks in the years to come. As the needs of the people changed, Moses showed himself unable to alter his leadership style. Ultimately, we know it would be for this reason that neither he nor any of the liberated Israelites would be permitted to enter into the promised land. And what is true for Moses and leadership, all the more so in our own lives. If one believes, as I do, that life is a play in multiple acts, that as Heraclitus wrote, the only thing that is constant is change, then each and every one of us must constantly anticipate and adapt, considering the question of what's next. None of us should willfully allow ourselves to be caught flat-footed. We must all be willing to turn and face the strange, face it, anticipate it, and adapt to it as it unfolds before us. Not only must we seek to understand the changing ecosystems in which we function, but we must demonstrate the self-awareness and suppleness of spirit by which our own roles may be transformed. It's not a task limited to statesmen and revolutionaries. It's a question for all of us, no matter the institutions we serve and the capacities by which we do so. If, after all, we would ask of others to extend to us the right to pivot and change course, should the need arise, then so too it follows, we must be prepared to grant that same courtesy to others. Leadership, if nothing else, is the ability to inspire another towards a belief that tomorrow holds the potential to be different than today, and that it's only by way of a person's unique contributions that a potential future can be actualized, be it in a corporate, synagogue, or any setting. It's an organization's ability to enthusiastically ask and embrace what's next that signals its readiness to adapt to new and uncharted terrain. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, it is in the most quiet and sacred relationships of our lives whereby we must be willing to embrace the question of what's next. Are we willing to grant that the needs of those we love most may be different tomorrow than they were yesterday and that they are today? As we identify our loved ones' changing hopes and articulate our own, we must be prepared to realign and redefine and adapt to our evolving selves. As our children grow and change before our very eyes, we must allow that the continued vitality of that relationship is contingent on our ability to revise and recalibrate the style and substance of our communications and expectations, be it parent to child or between any two people, A static relationship is not one that bears the potential for growth. We must ever be willing to turn over the topsoil of our own identities, knowing that only by doing so will we be able to breathe new life and plant fruit-bearing seeds for the future. For anyone interested in sustaining relationships through the inevitable passages of our lives, what comes next is a necessary question that must always be on our lips and always willing to be heard. Rabbi Yaakov taught in Pirkei Avot that this world is a vestibule for the world to come, and we must prepare ourselves in this vestibule should we wish to enter into the banquet hall that awaits us. I would amend his statement to say that this moment, that every moment, is a vestibule for the moment to come. And should we wish to enter into that world that awaits us, we must constantly prepare ourselves as such. Moses, the liberator of our people, the teacher of Israel par excellence, the man who shared an intimacy with God second to none, nonetheless had his limitations. It wasn't easy for him, all the more so for us, to think that tomorrow may make demands on our person that today exists beyond the scope of our vision. It wasn't easy for him to reinvent himself midstream, to imagine that future successes would call on him to discard an old playbook and write a new one. And yet we're grateful for the lessons learned, knowing those lessons find immediate application in our own journeys ahead. Oceans may rise and empires may fall, for we all know that the promised destinations ahead that we seek, we don't know yet where those destinations are. Should we wish to arrive intact, we must be prepared for it all, a nimbleness of spirit, ever ready to embrace what awaits us in the days to come. Shabbat Shalom.